folks. Another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis. And we're going to continue to explore the cultures of consciousness. Recently, I wrote an article for the online magazine Aeon, which is out of the UK, and it's really a pretty interesting zone. Some intelligent articles, very intelligent articles, straddling science, technology, modern culture, and but having a nice vein of spiritual and consciousness interests as well, in a non-woo-woo fashion. So it's a fun place to write for. And my recent piece there was on this fascinating ongoing saga or mini saga in Encinitas, California, Southern California, north of San Diego, where a very interesting court battle is unfolding regarding the status of yoga in public schools. To put it in a nutshell, private organization came up with a yoga curriculum for elementary schools and worked with the local school district there in Encinitas to get these classes into school, and everything seemed to be working out. The district was happy to have some free physical education, especially some that seemed to really be quite good for kids and for everyone. And they developed this curriculum and tried to make it as practical and pragmatic and physical culture oriented as possible. But some parents in the district took a great offense to the yoga program, particularly parents of the Christian persuasion, and came to the position that that yoga was inherently a religious practice, and that therefore including it in the school curriculum was a violation of the separation of church and state and the religious freedom clause in the California legal regimen organizing such things. And it's a very, very interesting question, and it produced a lot of commentary. A lot of people covered this event. There's been news reports and lots of jokes using all the sort of yoga terms to cover this thing. And as I was researching it and really wondering myself, well, is it inherent? What does it mean to say something's inherently religious? Because as a student of religion, as someone who's interested in religious currents in the modern world and how they transform and how they may look secular, but they have these religious roots, I have some sensitivity to the argument that yoga does have an inherently at least spiritual nature, although the difference between spirituality and religion is a very confusing thing for the courts, if not for human beings in general. So I was really grappling with this, and I was wondering how other people were working these problems out, how people inside the yoga community were thinking about it, because, on the one hand, people were like, oh, that's silly, it's just stretching, no big deal. Even the judge in the case was like, I do yoga. I know this is news to me that it's spiritual, and he did a different kind of yoga than inspired the curriculum. But the point being that that's sort of a natural response. But for a lot of yogis, it was kind of a more complicated problem, because they would have to recognize that even if they started the practice for purely physical or even psychological effects, stress reduction, a bad back, fitness, that many people, when they continue, probably most people, when they continue the practice over time, it inevitably becomes a little more rich and complex and unfolding in ways that make spiritual language or even religious language in terms of Hindu ideas and tantra and spiritual energy, that makes that language and those ideas much more attractive as a way to organize and understand the kinds of experiences they're having. So it's a tricky situation, and I was wandering through the interwebs, and I came across a really kind of startlingly intelligent blog about yoga by a woman who is our guest today, Carol Horton, and she had some very smart stuff to say about the case. And then I discovered that she also had written and recently published a book on yoga called Yoga PhD, Integrating the Life of the Mind and the Wisdom of the Body. And this is an excellent text. I wish it was required reading in yoga centers across the land, because Carol very self-consciously puts one foot in the world of practice, in the world of going through psychological, spiritual, physical transformation by a deep commitment to yoga. And she tells a lot of personal stories and really gives a good account of one practitioner's experience of yoga. But on the other hand, or the other foot, she is a scholar and knows and is quite drawn to the kinds of critical thinking, questions of history, questions of modern culture, of consumerism, of psychological projection, of a lot of the sort of critical questions that one might bring to yoga, and that indeed many do, although they usually bring it with a great deal of extra hostility. So in a way, it's a wonderful blend that kind of represents in some ways a lot of the things I'm trying to do with this show, which is to sort of navigate and explore this strange interzone between robust spiritual and metaphysical and religious practices and experiences and currents in the modern world, and a more critical sensibility grounded in the body, grounded in history, grounded in the problems and complexities of our modern condition. And it's a wonderful book, and again, I really hope that it begins to have an impact on the wider yoga community, which is not a community that's particularly enthusiastic about critical thinking, to its own detriment. And she really points to sort of a third way between the, you know, it's just a physical routine on the one hand, and it's an ancient religious practice handed down for thousands of years by mystical yogis who transcended the vagaries of ordinary human life. So I'm very happy that Carol's on the show today. But before we bring her on, of course, our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Daoud. Hi, Maja.
Hi, Eric. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Well, you know, we've talked about yoga on this this show before, and you've given me some of your. I mean, you're living in a hot spot of the full complexities and contradictions of American yoga, and I'm just kind of, but I'm really curious, because you've studied so much religion, and you also track these various spiritual currents in the modern world. Do you think, if you had to answer that question, do you think yoga, at least as it's currently practiced in the West, do you think it's inherently religious?
I totally do, dude. I don't think you could shake the God out of it if you try it. And this is the thing that's hilarious. Like, this is what made me upset about the whole dialogue with the whole thing with yoga in school and the whole, like, debate about it that was so dumb, is like, yoga is inherently religious because the whole thing started because of religion and the spiritual aspect of it. Just because people choose to, like, not have that in their mind when they're doing it, I do not think takes that out of it. Just like language comes from spiritual religion traditions, just like math in its origins come from spiritual religious traditions. So what made me upset was, if you're going to get mad that they're doing yoga because its origins are religious in nature, you would have to eliminate practically the entire curriculum from school, because if you track anything back far enough, sooner or later, it's going to get woo-woo, because everything comes from shamanism, and the majority of, you know, our cultures, agriculture, civilization, if you go back enough, angels and aliens bring it down according to whoever you talk about. So it's weird. Why choose yoga to,
What you're saying is that you're just taking it so broad, that rather than saying, like, out of all these secular things in our modern world, but yoga is one that, if you look at it, it really has this inherent religious spirit in it. You're saying, yeah, it does, but so does all that other stuff that you're
looking
at.
Exactly. Totally.
So there's no way out of the of the trace of God. That's a really
interesting thing. There's no escape, man.
So this is a great discussion already. So let's bring Carol into the mix. Carol, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Great. Well, I mean, you cover a lot of things in your book. I definitely want to get to those. But since we're talking about this particular case, I'd love it, and I know you've been tracking it closely. If you could give us kind of an update, like where things are at now, what has been some of the recent developments, things said, things that have intrigued you about this particular case.
Mm-hmm. So the basic situation was the case was on trial last week. It was anticipated to just take a couple of days and then be decided. Instead, what happened was that there were those few days of hearings, and then the judge decided that he wanted to know more. So one of the lawyers in the case had, I think, a prior commitment to go out of town, so the case is on recess until late this month. And then it will resume, and the idea is that a few more days of hearings will be enough, and then the judge will decide the case. There's no jury. So basically this is a pause in between Part A and Part B of this trial. And what's happened most recently is that both the plaintiffs and the defendants have issued statements. I saw them posted on a blog called The Confluence Countdown yesterday, which is an Ashtanga Yoga affiliated blog. And I also had spoken last week with a local reporter covering the case, Gary Worth, to get a sense of what it's like inside the courtroom. And both the statements that were just released and the news reports I'd been reading and my conversation with Mr. Worth all add up to the fact that what's happened so far is the two sides have squared off into absolutely opposing camps. So on the one side, the plaintiffs who brought the case are claiming that, as you've already discussed, yoga is inherently religious. And beyond that, that particular religion that it's most affiliated with, they feel, is Hinduism. So it's presented a little more complex way than that. It kind of boils down to Hinduism. On the other side, the school district is replying that this is absurd. This program, which we had control over designing, is an exercise program. And it's no more inherently religious or even spiritual than running or gymnastics or anything else, which, when you think about it, some people do feel is important to their own personal spirituality. But really, in the terms of our culture, their claim is it is exercise. So you've got these two completely oppositional positions. And the statements that I saw on the web yesterday also had a fairly, or more than fairly, hostile tone. So I think both sides are very exasperated and irritated with each other.
It's such a rich allegory. I mean, it's one of these things that happens where it comes out and you're almost grateful because it lets you see, you glimpse into the kind of underbelly of all of these really complicated issues. And I know that you've been tracking it, and you've already been asking these kinds of questions in terms of your book, which kind of charts a path that is both spiritual and in many ways very modern and in many ways secular, and you're kind of navigating that zone in between. So how have your feelings around this topic changed, and particularly because, when intellectuals sort of think about these things, we often sort of see these, oh, it's a mixture, it's complicated, there's a contradiction, it's a paradox. But when you're in a courtroom, the judge has to go yay or nay. Like, there's no way out. It's like the terms have been set in this black or white kind of zone, which forces a different kind of thinking about the problem. So I'm really curious to hear how you have changed in thinking about this case as it opens up these larger questions about yoga and our society.
Well, I'm hoping that the judge will not just say yay or nay to either side, but will actually carve out a more intelligent and thoughtful position, which I think is his prerogative to do so. There's really no knowing what he's going to rule at this point. My feeling right now is one of dismay. I think when the case first started, I was hopeful that it would spark an interesting conversation and investigation of what exactly is the nature of contemporary yoga in this society. And I think that's a conversation that needs to happen, and particularly because I'm very involved in the yoga service movement, which is the movement to bring the practice of yoga into major social institutions or to and or to populations that normally do not have access to it. So prisons, jails, hospitals, hospices, schools, low-income communities, etc. That movement's really taking off. So I see this case as potentially important in terms of framing the debate or framing the discussion of how yoga is understood as it moves into those sectors, and then also potentially really putting in some barriers or opening up some, or at least not placing, either placing barriers or not, in terms of moving yoga and continuing into publicly funded institutions. So at first I thought, well, this is happening already. There are these questions that are natural to ask. The role of yoga in the U.S. really hasn't been thought into in a very sophisticated way as it's expanded and boomed. So now this is going to force the question, and let's see what happens. So I was kind of hopeful that it would be interesting and even potentially valuable. And so far what's happened has only been interesting from a sort of, you know, like distanced, I don't really care about yoga, sort of social scientist perspective, and that, yeah, it's interesting, and that people have squared off into these completely opposing, narrow-minded, simplistic camps. It's interesting. It says a lot about the state of our culture, which is not very good in terms of what it says. But from the perspective of a yoga practitioner who thinks yoga is helpful and wants to see it moving into the society, particularly again into these areas it hasn't been, it's really discouraging, because not only do I not see an intelligent position emerging, but I don't really see enough concern or engagement. It's hard to gauge, of course, but I feel like the yoga community on the whole maybe hasn't bought into the idea that the questions raised in this case are, in fact, worth thinking into more seriously. And there is an attitude of, like, what would you,
as someone who's, you know, actively working to try and get yoga into more places, mm-hmm. how would you respond to how people are viewing it as a religious threat? Or, you know, maybe not threat, but that it's religious and just shouldn't be propagated.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think completely dismissing that is idiotic, which is kind of what's been done.
Right.
Is really unhelpful and also unfair. I think it's very unfair, in fact, because as you point out, the history of yoga is certainly bound up with what any fair-minded person would call religious and spiritual traditions. So there is that to answer to. Beyond that, much more immediately, is the fact that the Joyce Foundation, which funded this program, they gave a $500,000-plus grant to the school district to get the program, you know, operational. It's a nonprofit arm of Joyce Yoga. And Joyce Yoga, if you go to their website, they state that Ashtanga Yoga is all about spirituality, and they use fairly esoteric, more quote-unquote traditional yogic language to explain what that means. They have a whole series of lecture notes from Sharath Joyce, the son of Sri Patabi Joyce, who founded the Ashtanga system, explaining the philosophy behind Ashtanga Yoga, and I think it's not at all a stretch to read that and say, you know, this sounds religious, certainly deeply spiritual, so it's right there. And it kind of stuns me that, you know, the school district can go into the courtroom and sort of ignore the fact that
that's the thing, they're making the wrong argument. They're just not making the right argument. Right, it's kind of what is upsetting to me. Like, I agree with, like, why say, no, it's not, like, the more important argument is, so what? What isn't? You know, like, I don't understand why people are trying to deny that aspect of it. It's very strange to me.
Well, I understand why they want to deny it in the context of their own particular program, because if they said, yes, our program is religious, then it shouldn't and couldn't be in the public schools constitutionally. But, okay, the Joyce Yoga connection is a reasonable one to inquire about and should be explained. The extent to which they modified that curriculum, exactly how the relationship between the funder and the school district is going to unfold over time, given these issues, as far as I know, has never been explained. And also complicating the situation is the fact that Joyce Yoga has a whole research center that they funded, I believe, at the University of Virginia, that's going to be evaluating this program. And a program evaluation, I used to work in that field, you know, that's very important in terms of creating legitimacy for a big grant-making program and saying, you know, this is why it works and here's hard data and so on and so forth. So the kids are going to be not only doing the yoga, but they're going to be studied, and that research will presumably be used to help support the expansion of other programs. So I have to say that the more I looked at the Joyce Yoga website, the more I felt critical of them for not stepping up more to address the issues that have been raised, because if they have, I'm not aware of it, and also to have laid a better groundwork. Because I think what needs to have happened is there had to have been a very self-conscious and thorough restructuring of the yoga curriculum and philosophy for the school, and particularly given where it's coming from. I mean, some school yoga programs are, I know one that's run by a former school teacher who's the daughter of a principal, so she understands the school system, and you can be sure that you know, her website and references don't contain the sort of spiritual and religious language that the Joyce Yoga one does, and I think she comes from a different school of yoga, but whatever, she understands the territory she's moving into is a particular
a lot
one
of that
has
okay,
to be
so this,
respected.
This is a good example. A lot of that is just guilt by affiliation. Like, let's say you're a teacher, and you're a teacher at a public school, and you have a website about your Islamic beliefs, or just that your spirit, or like you have your Pentecostal church website, or you're, you know, involved in a church, but you teach at a school. Like, I don't see the difference between having affiliation with things, but then still being able to teach in a non-denominational manner at a school. Like, if they're not, like, having a curriculum inherent with those things, like, if it's only an affiliation thing, why could they be punished any more than a teacher that is religious but doesn't teach the religion in the school?
Oh, I agree. I'm not meaning to suggest that they're not free to have whatever beliefs they want and still fund programs and to you know, to punish the program simply because of that affiliation would be discriminatory. So I think you're totally right. I'm speaking more in terms of cultural sensitivity, buy-in, you know, sort of thoughtfulness in terms of laying the foundation for a conversation that's really new, for a phenomenon that's fairly new, sort of being a leader in the field. I think it's really important to just try and lay a really solid foundation, and I think a lot of people with strong religious beliefs, not all for sure, but a lot who would be put off by the idea that yoga is inherently religious in a Hindu sense, if they were spoken to in a respectful, inclusive way, if their concerns were listened to, you know, I think there could be a dialogue there to find a common ground.
Yeah.
Now, that said, I think there's also potentially some religious activists involved in this case who would not be amenable to that sort of thing. But I think you have to at least try.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of what I meant by what an amazing sort of, you know, whatever, kind of an allegory of our moment in so many ways, is that the mistakes that the Joyce Foundation did out of, let's just say, lack of awareness of some of the problems, to some degree, I would argue, a little bit of a lack of respect for the intensity of the of secular claims and the positive characteristic of having a strict separation, or at least as strict as possible, at least in theory, and a certain kind of hubris. There was a certain kind of hubris in their material and their vision for it and the way that they brought it through, at least that I sense, even though I couldn't necessarily nail it down, and maybe it reflects some of my other understandings of yoga, and particularly Ashtanga, but through all of that, I don't think they were aware at all of what a juicy item of paranoia this provides for conservative Christians. And as someone who's has always long been fascinated by conservative Christianity, particularly when it starts to get, you know, really imaginative in its depicting its understanding of the world as a kind of battleground of demonic forces and the sort of, you know, what's behind the surface of seemingly innocuous things like, you know, rock records and stuff like that. I've always loved that stuff and been fascinated and horrified by it at the same time. That this was just like, a gimme. It was so obvious that it was so well set up to draw out precisely the passion of these conservative religious activists who are almost looking exactly for this kind of thing to make these points and also to sort of propagate to other conservatives the reality, the urgency around fighting the spiritual battle at every step of the way, and that it's everywhere you look, it's in your schools, and da-da-da-da-da. And the material was just so, you know, perfect for that kind of reaction. And so part of the unhappiness I hear from you about what this could have been, what it could have evolved in, and then what it did evolve in, is, like you say, it's just another sad reflection of the polarization of our society. It's so boring to even talk about it, and yet that's what seems to happen. There's a middle ground, a tender, tentative space of possibility, and so many forces, media, logistical, attitudinal, political, they reproduce this binary, this split, and it is, it is very unfortunate. Now, here's a question for you. Since you, you know, recognize and understand the complicated way that yoga is sort of inherently spiritual or religious in some sense, how that's evolved and how it's changing now, but it's still a strong argument, and as someone who's interested in bringing yoga into spaces that need to be clearly defined as secular, how do you see playing that, or what would be the better case that one would make, you know, from the Joyce Foundation perspective? What was the kind of claim or concept about yoga that you would have liked to have heard come up more in the discussion, either in the courtroom or in the discussion around the case?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's not an easy position to articulate. And I've been, trying to think, like, in a nutshell, how could I explain what would be that middle ground? And I'm still kind of struggling with really trying to get that nailed down into a really simple package. But I would say something along the lines of, first, let's start by looking empirically at what yoga in America is today. I mean, rather than going off into abstract theories or, ancient history or whatever, let's just look on the ground what's happening, okay? And what you can see there is it's an enormously variegated practice. Lots of people do it just for exercise. For some people it is a serious spiritual practice. For some people it is bound up with religion, but not necessarily Hinduism, often Christianity, in fact. There's a whole range. There's atheists into yoga. There's scientists interested in yoga. So that's just a fact, okay? And then you look at that fact a little more closely, take some data. So the Yoga Journal recently did a market survey, 2012, and it's really the best data we have in terms of how people think about and experience yoga, because it's a representative cross-sample of the American population. So I looked at that, and, if people are asked, why are you motivated to keep practicing yoga? Out of 9 reasons, the last one is spiritual development. So it comes right behind weight loss, right? So the majority of the reasons are things like, I feel better, exercise, stretching, stress reduction, blah, blah, blah. So the fact of the matter is that the solid majority of Americans don't experience yoga as a spiritual practice or as connected with religion, but yet a substantial minority do. So that's just a fact, and I think it's really important to kind of stay grounded in as best we can, you know, some sort of empirical, concrete reality that both sides could hopefully agree on.
Okay. Well, again, I would just interject there really quickly.
Yeah.
If you asked everyone the same survey about art or music, in some of the top, you know, answers, it would be for spiritual development, which means we couldn't teach that in the curriculum either, right? So, I mean, yes, that's obviously a component, but again, like in some of the major things they teach in school, that would be people's response to it, totally.
Yeah. Well, but then you'd say, how are they teaching it, and is that? I mean, to me, the litmus test would be, is the spiritual component or religious component at all directive or explicit? Or
right.
is it sort of an open, a space of experience that's open for interpretation? Now, consider the fact that a moment of silence in public schools has been upheld in the courts.
Hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Right.
Totally. That's a great example.
Yeah. So as long as you are not telling people, this is a time to pray to Jesus or, you know, worship Shiva or even, you know, connect with the neurons firing in your brain and realize that there is no such thing as God, you know, whatever, you don't tell them how to interpret their experience.
Right.
You simply teach people a practice that, insofar as there are any directives about how to understand it, it's strictly confined to the physical and simple psychological health benefits.
Yeah.
So that's it. Leave everything else up to the individual. And I feel that's actually ethically the way it should certainly be taught in those contexts. Nothing should be directed or pushed. I wouldn't want my kids to go in and be given some sort of meditation in school and then be told what to make of that in terms of their spirituality. I would be against that, too.
Yeah, that's a wonderful response. We got to take a break right now. This is a great conversation. We'll be right back after these messages. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Dawu. We're talking with Carol Horton about contemporary yoga.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Dawu here chit-chatting with Eric Davis and Carol Horton. We're talking about yoga and its role. And specifically, we've been talking about that big case for putting yoga into schools and kind of making it a little more mainstream. And Carol's book discusses a lot about yoga philosophy and where it kind of comes from and what role it plays in culture. And I wanted to ask you too, Carol, like just because, I mean, I'm obviously a big yoga fan. I love yoga. I think it's great whether or not no matter what religious practice you are, it's one of those kind of things that you can do no matter what your tradition is. And I'm just curious, like, since the sticker that seemed, like Eric said, like that big push button, for a lot of the conservative Christians, it seems to be like causing a lot of the ruckus and setting a lot of the people up as they're like saying like, well, it's Hindu and that it has this affiliation with Hinduism. But is that really even true? Like if you go way back into yoga and its origins, I mean, I don't know. You could kind of argue that it's one of those non-affiliated practices that doesn't really, I mean, because people in India, people that weren't Hindus practice yoga, if I'm not mistaken, like many of the yogis aren't Hindus. They come from many different religions, like Shaivite or, you know, all kinds of different things. So this, one of my like kind of big things with the whole religious thing too, do you feel like just because it's getting affiliated with Hinduism, is that the big stinker?
Well, essentially, yeah. I think the fact that it can be, I don't think it's accurate to conflate it with Hinduism. I mean, that's such a big set of questions that you just raised. But I do feel that if that association is strongly made, it is a big kind of panic button issue. in certain sectors, conservative Christian world. And I don't feel it's legitimate to equate the two at all.
I don't think it's true.
And I do feel, yeah, I don't feel it's true, but I also feel like you have to tread carefully because you have, for example, about a year or so ago, maybe a year and a half, the Hindu American Foundation complaining that people weren't recognizing that yoga is as Hindu as it actually is, and sort of a, you know, we're being disrespected because nobody even thinks there's any connection. And so there's a lot of complex questions in terms of how to interpret the history. I've seen a lot of in-depth arguments about it, but and we can go into that, but I will certainly say without hesitation that saying that yoga is inherently Hindu just makes, it does not hold water as far as I'm concerned in terms of contemporary practice or in terms of history. You make it that simple, it's just wrong.
I mean, because I feel like Eric mentioned, that's the big thing that's kind of setting everybody off, is that it has been affiliated with a religion, but that is not true. And I really feel like if, like, for promulgating it and trying to get more people into it, I think a lot of the points that you raised were very good. There are scientists that do it. There are Christians that are doing it. Even though it's a spiritual practice, it's not religious affiliated. So I feel like if we can get over that, that might help push it through to get, you know, more people to be able to do it. But, again, the thing is perception. Like, how is it perceived? Because that's going to be
I want to take this question of perception in a little bit different direction and pick up something you noted earlier, that one of your disappointments with watching this case unfold and the reaction to it unfold is you had some disappointments about how the yoga community itself was sort of not really taking it up with the richness and passion that you would have liked to see. And since a lot of your book contains some, you know, sometimes trenchant and in my experience, all very well placed and argued critiques of contemporary American yoga, and this from someone who's you know, you're deeply invested in it, you're passionate about it, it's transformed your life in many ways. And so I'm curious whether, like, how you see the reaction to this case and its needs and the issues that it raised. How does that reflect some of the problems with the yoga community in terms of their willingness or ability to be able to engage these critical questions and really sort of create a newer framework for understanding yoga in American society? What are the things that are preventing the flowering of a more, well, critically nuanced kind of yoga practice?
That's a really interesting question. It's hard to say for sure. I mean, if you look back in terms of recent history, you can see the boom of yoga that started in the last several decades as tied in with the element of the 1960s counterculture that really went in the direction of withdrawing from society, rejecting politics, and so on. So I think in terms of its development in our own culture, it's been on a trajectory since, you know, certainly at least the late 60s, early 70s, that's larger than yoga itself, that's bound up with a kind of, or overlaps, let's say, with sometimes a New Age type sensibility or, you know, a part of our culture that's really all about sort of withdrawing from critical social engagement. So I think that's part of just how it's unfolded here. Beyond that, I think if there's some interesting stuff I could speculate on, you know, yoga, as we practice it here, is obviously a very physical practice. We also have mainly women who are practitioners. And I've always found it really interesting, and this is just an observation, again, culturally, how this plays out. When I started looking for interesting writing on yoga, I couldn't find a whole lot that wasn't about philosophy or how to practice asana. So I was looking for something about yoga in contemporary society, and this was a couple years ago, there wasn't a whole lot. And then so I looked over at the Buddhist literature, and there was a lot. I mean, they had been debating questions about Buddhism and feminism and Buddhism and consumer society and, you know, Buddhism and science and adapting the practice to the West and blah, 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 since the 1970s. And the fact is that the Buddhist world, you know, they're kind of not into the body on the whole. So, you know, you sit still, you meditate, you work with your mind. it's more male-dominated. So, I mean, there's a part of me that's always just kind of wondered, like, does the yoga, meditation, mindfulness, cultural divide in our society sort of play out along stereotypical gender lines and body-mind division lines? I mean, there's a way in which that just seems to be true.
Yeah.
There's also the way in which yoga, so there's, I'm just, you know, one more factor I'll add in, is that in the past 15 years, as yoga has really taken off and become pretty huge, it's really moved into the consumer marketplace and the spiritual marketplace in a big way, and a lot of the growth in its popularity has come from just binding it up with the images and tropes of, you know, beautiful body and, you know, kind of the ideal of serenity achieved through control over the physical and so on. And so that also is something to work. You cannot think critically into it because then you start questioning the advertising and the imagery and so on and so forth, and it unravels for you if that's what attracted you into it. So there's a lot going on. And I can't really give a single definitive answer.
No, those were all really great. I mean, the thing that comes to mind, and that I think your book is a part of, is that one of the ways, you know, it's not a double bind. It's that these factors are there. We are in this consumer society because the body is engaged, because it is a life-giving and a physique-improving practice. It's inevitable in our current environment that those kinds of situations are going to arise, and then people are making money, and then you have the sort of adulation of teachers, which is another, you know, problem that you talk about quite well in your book. And what I come to is, like, those things are going to be happening. There are these historical legacies to be dealt with, and what you really need is sort of like what you say, what you see in Buddhism is a space for kind of critical thinking, that like, so that as one becomes a yogi, you recognize that there is a world, that there are issues to be raised, there's problems with gender and problems with self-objectification, and that part of it is that it's more about the consumerism than anything, in the following sense, that the model, the what's being sold, the picture that one is entering into, it almost intentionally does not allow the space for these kinds of discussions. I was very intrigued in your book where you mentioned how, as you were dealing with these questions of the cultural place of yoga today and how it interfaces with other aspects of our culture and negative things about it, that you're saying you were looking for material, and you went and looked on the bookshelves, and it's either, you know, yet another book about Patanjali, or, you know, books with rock star teachers on how to do asana, but in the internet, in the blogosphere, you found a lot more. And that was really interesting because that was my discovery when I was researching his piece. I had never really looked at the yoga blog world. I followed links from your blog. You know, I read around a bunch of stuff, and it was really heartening for me to go, oh, yeah, no, this stuff is happening. People are asking these questions. It's just that they're sort of in this kind of space, and you don't really see it. It's not part of the culture of going to a yoga studio or going to the gym or whatever. And it's really in trying to create more reflection around these contradictions and to look at them and to engage them, again, kind of like you see with a lot of Buddhist discourse, which also has a very strong feminist dimension to it. And so, you know, in a way, like, I'm cautiously hopeful that maybe things like that maybe it can happen, but it does seem to be a bit of a, you know, like a kind of race against this, you know, extraordinary consumer ideal that gets reproduced in class, and not even just in terms of, and I'd like to hear you, this is my kind of question out of this ramble, is how it's not just about that you look good, it's the body, you wear these kinds of clothes, there's a Ganesha on the wall, it's kind of cool, like a decorative design, I can buy my own, da 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 da, but it's also something that happens as yoga begins to open up these psychological spaces, the encounter with trauma, the encounter with altered states in the context of the room, and it's like, what happens with that stuff? How is that being understood? How is that being worked or not worked in the context of contemporary practice? And whether that might be also a way of, well, making yoga more intelligent, I think is one way of saying it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that ties back into the Encinitas case, too, because the more subtle level of questioning that comes up beyond, you know, is yoga Hindu, is does practicing yoga open up a new space in terms of your experience, your consciousness, and do conservative Christians and their worldview have reasons to be concerned about that? So, to be fair, I mean, that's an important question. So just to backtrack, I would say, you know, in terms of more critical thinking in the yoga world and questioning and so on, I definitely see a shift in the zeitgeist, and while it's definitely a minority movement, there are a good number of people who have all at the same time kind of independently started thinking and writing, reflecting and speaking about some of the same issues. It's really in the last couple of years. And the number of interesting books and so on just since 2010 has really, given how low it was before, kind of exponentially grown. So I see a real shift happening. That said, you know, it's small, and it's not going to be something that, I don't know, the casual person looking at yoga culture in America is going to necessarily notice. In terms of that larger culture, you know, I think it's important not to pit oneself against it, because the fact of the matter is that many people do come into yoga for banal reasons. I want to look better, whatever. I mean, I just start because I want to stretch out. And they do end up having experiences that open them up to sort of a deeper connection with life, let's just say. And that can happen in very also banal environments. So, for example, I know people who, you know, have had amazing experiences lying in Shavasana at Core Power Yoga, you know. So I think you just can't say, like, you know, this is commercial and bad and corporate and worthless and this is good and pure. And it's that sort of trying to divide the pure and the impure, the authentic from the inauthentic and all that sort of stuff that I argue against in my book. Yep. In terms of the experience, and that's a space that needs to be, I think, better articulated and sort of solidified as a cultural resource, almost, is how I think about it. But I think there's something really important going on. As people practice yoga, take the time to, you know, step out of everyday life and have a moment just to be, to connect more deeply with themselves and feel something important shift. It's happening to millions of people, and that's why they value it. And I think what tends to happen is that there's a stampede to either fit that into some kind of simplistic pre-existing meaning or to just sort of not really deal with it in terms of conscious meaning and not therefore really integrate it into your life. So I think we need to kind of grow that open space as a valuable experience that yoga practice today leads people to. And I think the kind of post-postmodern view of it would be that there's something there that does feel almost universal in terms of how it's shared, but then people come away from that and give it different meanings. So there's a diversity. So for one person, you know, they connect it to their Christian faith. For another person, they connect it to the wonders of science. Whatever, that diversity of meanings is, I think, fine and natural in a society like ours. But if we could also see that there's something more unifying there that maybe we can articulate, and I think that's the missing sort of ground of cohesion and the missing counterpart to fundamentalist religion, right? Because I think the Encinitas case kind of sets it up beautifully. It's like either it's exercise and, you know, like there's nothing deep, you know, like we can't go there. We can't even begin to go there because it's too threatening, so we're going to keep it in that box. Or it's this kind of stereotyped doctrinal religion, boogeyman. What's missing is a space of enriching human life and experience that I think is what is really valuable about the practice today, and that's not being articulated.
Well, I feel like that's true, and you can look at acupuncture as a good example of how that kind of thing is possible, right? If you look at what Chinese medicine has gone through, to me it's a little similar to what's kind of happening with yoga presently. Like, know, Chinese medicine started with the Wu, the shaman in China, and it was inherently religious in its practice until, you know, the communist revolution, and then they called it traditional Chinese medicine, and they removed all the old ghost parts and demon exorcisms. That they removed all that language from the practice and articulated it just, you know, they Bikramized it, and then it made it like more disseminable and just was looking at like what can it actually provide. And now it's all over the United States, but you can find an acupuncturist almost everywhere. I mean, I don't know about Kentucky, but it was because there was that kind of like, they didn't, like you said, like exactly what you just described is kind of how acupuncture and Chinese medicine was able to penetrate, was exactly by looking at the benefits that it gives, just focusing on those and not looking at any of that other stuff, right?
Yeah, I mean, the tough thing is this sort of benefit is very hard to describe in a culturally recognizable way, right? So we have the best term we have is spiritual. I mean, what does that mean, you know? And I think for a lot of people, it means something sort of like religion or just like religion. I mean, in Anthony's case, the plaintiffs are arguing there is no difference. It is religion. For a lot of people, it means, you know, it's sort of not traditional religion, but it's some other thing, and they may believe in who knows what, angels or any number of belief systems that are out there. And, you know, I've thought a lot of what do I mean when I use this term spiritual, because I don't really mean either of those things, but what I mean is that it's taking me to a place that I value.
They use the term well-being, right? Mm-hmm. I think well-being is kind of a better way to describe it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that gets right down to the crux that we're unfortunately going to be after where we leave it is, like, well-being is part of a healing idea, an idea of some kind of medical work, whereas the spiritual implies some other dimension. It's a little bit beyond the medical model, which is easier to get across. And I really agree with you that we're wrestling with how to describe that. It's almost like a third space between secular rationality and science and traditional religion. But we're going to have to wind up there. Carol, I want to give you a chance to let people know about what your where your website is and other ways for people to find out about you and your work.
Okay, great. So I have a website, carolhortonphd.com, and you'll find links to a lot of my online writing there, plus I have two books. I have the Yoga PhD book, which I wrote myself, and just about a month before that, I published a book called 21st Century Yoga, Culture, Politics, and Practice, which is a co-edited volume of essays. My co-editor is Roseanne Harvey, who's a blogger in Montreal. Her blog is called It's All Yoga Baby, and she's the former editor of Ascent magazine out there. And we have 10 incredible writers in that book talking about stuff like yoga in contemporary North America and how it connects to contemporary spirituality, yoga and recovery from addiction, yoga and activism, politics, and that sort of thing. So the books are there, and the writing, and, you know, other miscellaneous stuff. So that's the best way to connect with me online.
Great. Well, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thanks so much. It was a great conversation.
Okay. So for me and Majid, all you out there, keep your minds open.